Hello from San Francisco and welcome to the Haight Street Beat, where we explore the past, present, and future of this beautiful city from the heart of the psychedelic capital of the world, the Haight-Ashbury. Any neighborhood is best understood by the people who've lived there, and my guest David Wiseman called the Haight home from the late 1970s until around 2015. David and his filmmaking partner Bill Weber created two documentaries that are essential viewing to better understand the Haight in the 60s and the Castro in the 70s and 80s. The Cockettes documents a psychedelic drag theater group who queered sexuality, gender, and monogamy with their unique brand of musical theater. David also produced We Were Here, which documents the all-too-real human impact of the AIDS crisis in the Castro in the 1970s and 80s. We join David as he discusses what it was that inspired him to move to San Francisco in the late 1970s and what the neighborhood was like then.
I was living in Venice Beach. I grew up in L.A., and I didn't go to college. I was living in Venice Beach, being a kind of a hippie and conga drummer and political activist. And I'd always been more strongly identified with my hippie side than my gay side, which was a slow process of finding both my own comfort internally as well as my tribe. And while there was a kind of a alternative queer community in Venice Beach in those years, I still felt more like a hippie and I didn't really quite know where I fit in. And, you know, it was a visit to San Francisco in 76 that was the first time that I really connected with gay San Francisco. And San Francisco to me had always meant hippies and Haight-Ashbury and the Avalon Ballroom and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I was drawn into the kind of countercultural ethos at like 11. You know, I had older sisters. So San Francisco really to me was like it was always Mecca, but never from a gay vantage point, always from a hippie vantage point. So in the summer of 76, I went up to visit a friend, a former LA Venice Beach friend. It was on that trip that I kind of looked around, and it was really at the Gay Freedom Day Parade, which was what it was called then, that I thought, oh, this is where my people are. Because the whole beginning of the Gay Freedom Day Parade was, you know, leftists and long-haired people and crazy artists. And I just realized this is where my people have been. And it all started to make sense. And Venice in those years was coming into its first real serious period of gentrification, which I was finding painful. So I thought, okay, it's time to move to San Francisco. The first place I lived was in the Haight. The first place I lived was, which was just for a month, was at Broderick and Haight with a couple of friends. One of them was a tightrope walker. And San Francisco was magic. San Francisco was magic to me even before the hippies. When I was a little kid and I'd go to Dodger Giant games, you know, I secretly loved the Giants because they were from San Francisco. But the smells of the city, I mean, it smelled kind of like pot and patchouli all the time. And it just had a sense of urban countercultural magic that LA, you couldn't really manifest in the same way, even in Venice. It just wasn't the same as San Francisco, which was so much the kind of, again, as I said, the Mecca of all of it. And, you know, what I found in San Francisco was this incredibly beautiful, active community of, again, political activists, gay people. People called themselves cultural workers. I mean, there was this incredible sense of ferment in a way that the 60s had started to diminish and wind down in the early 70s in most of the world. And yet in San Francisco, it was the opposite. It's like the ethos of the 60s just became more deeply and profoundly integrated into the life of the city. So it was this remarkable place of culture and activism and sexuality. It was a fantastic place. And my first boyfriend lived right at the corner of Haight and Ashbury. I don't remember what the store was on the corner, but it was literally his window looked right out on the corner of Haight and Ashbury. And in the 70s, really, it was gay people. It was primarily gay men, hippie gay men who kind of recolonized the Haight after a period of it being really boarded up and really, really dangerous. It was really gay men who kind of brought it back to life. And the new businesses, a lot of the new businesses on Haight Street were, you know, gay owned. And so for me, it was this incredible thing. There were all these like, you know, gay hippies in their 20s living in the Haight. I didn't live there until 78, but it sort of was the natural neighborhood for me to gravitate towards because the Castro was a little different. Yeah, so the Haight was pretty magic, actually. I mean, all up and down Ashbury Street, there was all these buildings that different friends of mine lived in. And people were sunbathing nude on their roofs. And you know, there was a bar called The Stud that we all went to back in those days that was on Folsom Street, and it was sort of the hippie gay bar. I don't know, it was just an amazing, amazing time. And again, the intersection of politics and culture and sexuality was just so profound in San Francisco. I, both by temperament and by kind of career, I'm something of an amateur historian. So I think I look, my tendency to look back is through a historian's mindset, but also with a personal vantage point. You know, I think that it was really when I was making We Were Here, which was after 2009, that it really occurred to me for the first time in a deep way that the AIDS epidemic started 11 years after Stonewall. And it's like, wow, that was an enormous, enormous, enormous blow to happen when we were just beginning to get a sense of who we were and to establish some sense of power and cohesion and sense of entitlement even as a community. And again, when you're in the middle of something, you're not really aware in the same sense of a timeline and a historical time frame. I mean, and in that time frame is Harvey Milk getting assassinated as well, which was a total, you know, body, mind, soul blow to the whole community. But part of the window one develops looking back on things like that is through the questions of younger people. And so many people, younger gay men particularly, have a kind of an idealized sense of San Francisco in the 70s from a sexual freedom vantage point, the pre-AIDS sexuality when we didn't have that weight hanging over us. And there's a mix of cynicism around that also, which is that, oh, it's overly romanticized and you old people are nostalgic for something that wasn't really real. And of course, it was a complex experience. But when I really think back on, not just in terms of the sexuality, which was not my central focus, but when I think back again on the atmosphere of San Francisco in the late 70s, I think it was one of the great times in American history and great places to be. Very different from being there in the 60s. It was an extension of that, but it was, you know, it was much more evolved in a way. So, you know, I look back with an enormous gratitude that I happened to make the choice when I did and got to San Francisco for an incredible flowering of both the LGBT world and the kind of extended milieu of San Francisco as a kind of a countercultural hub.
In 1977, Harvey Milk was elected to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. This was the first time in San Francisco's history that board elections were held as political districts as opposed to an at-large basis, which shifted the nexus of political power away from downtown and towards the neighborhoods. Harvey became the first openly gay man to be elected in public office in California, and you were in the room where it happens. On election night, you were at Harvey's now famous camera shop on Castro Street. What was that like?
It's funny because I didn't even remember that except for the fact that I was in a photograph that Danny Nicoletta took. And it's like, what am I doing there? You know, because most of the people in that picture are insiders. You know, there's people sitting at a table. You know, they're obviously going over precinct results and they're tallying, you know, get out the vote and whatever it was. And I realized it was my friend Bill Krause who took me in there, who I realized only decades later probably had a crush on me. And that was why I wound up in that room. But, you know, I think about it wasn't that much earlier that I wasn't sure who I was going to vote for. I mean, I was very left wing. From L.A., the perspective that one had on Harvey Milk from the gay newspapers was that he was a bit of a clown. And, you know, I'd never seen pictures of Harvey with long hair. So I didn't know that he'd been a hippie as well, which would have made a big difference to me. But I just sort of thought, well, my responsibility is to vote for the most left wing person on the ballot. So I was sort of trying to assess who was the most left wing. And I ran into this person, Bill Krause, who is a remarkable political activist, gay activist in San Francisco. I ran into him on the street. This was before Harvey's election. And, you know, I mentioned that I might be voting for this guy, Ron Green, who ran a record store in Noe Valley. And Bill just laid into me with the most profound political lecture. And my mouth was hanging open. And he totally convinced me. And I thought, boy, I hope I'm able to speak that way someday with such passion and clarity of intention and devotion to a cause with no ambiguity at all. So a few weeks later, Harvey won, and there I was, and it was very exciting to be there. I mean, again, you don't have the sense of historicality in the same way as you do looking back on a moment like that. And again, it's odd to look back and in a sense have my memories shaped by the photographs that I've seen of myself at that night rather than necessarily direct memories.
Now, you've used the term hippie a couple of times, and I'd be very curious to hear how you would define that term.
It's a good question because I think I use the word, depending on circumstances, both disparagingly and in a complimentary way. You know, it's like, oh, he's such a hippie. But, you know, I think of myself as an old hippie in a lot of ways. Part of it was growing up in LA in a liberal Jewish family in the 60s where, you know, politics and social activism and just being engaged with the world, that was just what life was. I mean, it never occurred to me that there was anyone who lived any differently. You know, I remember wearing a JFK for president button to school when I was like six. You know, it was just part of the atmosphere, the kind of sense of idealism. You know, I had two older sisters, and for whatever reason, whatever kind of core part of my identity that you can never define, I was immediately drawn to everything that reflected any kind of new cultural expression. And it was all happening. I mean, I feel, again, so lucky to have been that age with older sisters and to, you know, to watch the album covers of the Beatles change and to watch, you know, to go to record stores and like look through the album covers like I was, you know, looking at Playboys. It was like, look at, you know, because you were looking at something so surreptitious to see these psychedelic album covers. It's like something is going on. You know, other kids my age weren't necessarily drawn to it, but for whatever reason, I was from the get-go. And I, you know, anytime there was an article about anything, you know, even before the Summer of Love stuff, I was just drawn to it. I loved seeing the Hells Angels riding down the street, all filthy and greasy with long hair, because it was so counter to kind of bourgeois norms. So I think for me, my sense of what it is very much based around the San Francisco scene of the 60s, as opposed to the New York scene. I mean, to me, the idealism really appealed to me. The aesthetic of it really appealed to me. The language of mind expansion and psychedelics and, you know, spirituality to the extent that it was manifesting. And the bands, all of that stuff. I mean, I just thought, you know, all I wanted to do was to move to Haight-Ashbury and be a hippie. And I was like, you know, it was before my bar mitzvah. You know, I was like 12 years old. For my bar mitzvah, I got the first Hendrix album and the first Dead album and the first Doors album and, you know, the first Airplane album, you know, in the summer of 67. So I don't know why. I mean, there's always a question going back in motivation in life. And it's like, well, why did it appeal to you? And it's like, I don't know. But something in me had that draw to counterculture from the get-go. But when I use the word in a positive sense, as opposed to a pejorative one, it involves an intersection of idealism and politics and psychedelia and art and really wanting to change the world. I mean, the idealism is for me a kind of a necessary piece of my positive sense of what it means to be a hippie.
What role do you think psychedelics played in promoting freedom of expression in the late 60s in the Haight-Ashbury?
Well, I mean, this is something that millions of people have spoken to, and I think that I would sort of defer to the people older than me to talk about how it affected them as the first line of experimenters. I think for me, I was aware of it from the get-go as an 11 or 12 year old. And so there was always a kind of intrigue around Timothy Leary and this whole sense of consciousness expansion. I think it's almost impossible from this point in time for a younger person to even imagine what pot smoking and psychedelic use meant in those years. It's totally different now. And it was so integrated into a movement that was new, as opposed to being integrated into something that has existed for 50 years. I mean, everything was new then. And so there was such this sense of profound potential in the kind of drug experience, the drug community. And I say these both in a positive sense. You know, I mean, dealers were like cool guys. I didn't take acid until I was, I think, probably in my late 16-year-old or maybe early 17-year-old, but certainly it was around me. I smoked pot certainly earlier than that. But acid for me was completely a life-changing experience. I mean, both the anticipation of it and the actuality of the first trip that I took. I mean, totally life-changing in ways that I'm still learning about. You know, I used to kind of have a story around, you know, when people would ask me if I had a spiritual life or a spiritual identification, I would say, well, not really, but to the extent that I do, it probably emerges from my first experience from LSD. And, you know, that was kind of an okay story for me for a while. And then it occurred to me like, well, I was not a blank slate when I took the LSD. I was 16 or 17 years of human being that chose to take the LSD with the people that I chose to take it with, where I chose to take it. So it was a combination of the experience itself and what I brought to it as the person that I was. And that's the mystery. But for me, it was an incredibly beautiful day. I was with two friends, both of whom had done acid before, and they really wanted to be with me for my first acid trip. We went up to a beautiful kind of isolated beach north of LA. And I just felt such a sense of awe at how little I knew and how little I would ever be able to know. And really the awe itself became the experience. It's like, wow, you know, what we think of as normal and what we think of as reality is really only the confines of our own brains. And what is out there is so much bigger than we'll ever be able to grasp. And that in and of itself was a very liberating experience, because one can apply that in so many aspects of life. And of course, when you're tripping, it's different than after you're tripping, because it becomes then an intellectualized memory. But it started for me with pot. First few times I smoked pot, the common experience was you would laugh hysterically for hours. You know, everything was absolutely hilarious. And it was only a few years back that I really started to think about that. And well, what was I laughing about? It's very clear to me that what I was laughing about was that so many things that up until that moment had seemed completely normal, all of a sudden seemed completely absurd. You know, cars and grocery stores and advertising and the way we talk to each other and, you know, the way people dress, it was all of a sudden, it's like, this is completely insane. The world that we live in is completely insane. And it took me getting high to really have a vantage point on that. And so that extended into the psychedelic experience in a more cosmic way.
The communal nature of the hate in the late 1960s is one of the least understood and discussed aspects of that time frame. It was a unique counterpoint to the dominant social modes of economic and social organization. In speaking with people who lived their lives within this communal framework, did you get a sense that they felt that it was a successful and viable alternative to the conventional norms today?
You know, I'm in a weekly Zoom group with this as being sort of one of the central focuses of the group. I mean, and it's with a bunch of people who were part of the Cauliflower Commune and connected with the Diggers as well. So this is a very present part of my, you know, thoughts these days. One of the things just to precede that is that one of the consistent comments that I'll get after screenings from people is, wow, that part about there being 300 communes in the city was incredible, because it isn't something that's talked about much. And it is one of those things that even when I got there in 76, was one of the remarkable things about San Francisco was the integration of this whole kind of communal and collectively run businesses. And that was incredible. I mean, the whole city was so filled with this alternatively structured world of the people's food system and the people's bakery and all of these things that came out of those early years of both the Diggers and then into the early years with these other communes. Whether it's a success or not a success, I think everybody who lived through that period would answer it differently, depending on their own journey. I think in this particular group that I've been having these weekly discussions with, I definitely think that people realize how naive they were in regard to certain things, and that there were certain aspects of it that were not healthy. You know, some communes had leaders in certain ways that were probably not very healthy. I think certain kind of very idealistic principles around sexuality and around shared money and ownership and certain kinds of laxity around rules, some of that stuff had, you know, didn't turn out so well. But I don't think anybody who lived through that, who I know, has any regrets. I feel like that it all so deeply informed their deeper selves and still live to a significant degree with a sense of wanting to contribute to the world in a kind of positive and loving and creative ways. And there were so many different kinds of communes in San Francisco. I mean, it really was a city that embraced the idea of alternatives to the consumerist and capitalist norm like no other place in the world, I don't think. I mean, it was really remarkable. And some of it stayed urban and some of it went rural. I mean, there was obviously lots of rural communes. People left San Francisco pretty early after the Summer of Love to start rural communes in Northern California and Oregon. But a lot of people stayed in the city. They wanted the urban experience. A lot of it wasn't in the hate, particularly after those first years. It was, you know, spread out all over the city, but the communes were interconnected and they wound up developing these institutions through the communes. You know, the free food family sort of evolved into Veritable Vegetable, and, you know, the people's food system, which when I got there in 76, there was like 25 collectively owned food stores in San Francisco. I mean, it was incredible. You know, you go buy a loaf of bread at the people's food stores and in the, you know, be made by the people's bakery, and the cheese you'd get was from Red Star Cheese, which is a socialist food cheese collective. And then in the bread, there would be a flyer with, you know, the 7 or 8 demonstrations that were going on that week. And so the integration of culture and politics and food and communality was extraordinary.
From 1969 to 1972, there was a psychedelic hippie theater group called the Cockettes, who would queer gender, sexuality, and monogamy while performing numbers like Gone with the Showboat to Oklahoma between screenings of films in North Beach, which included the early works of John Waters. David produced and co-directed with Bill Weber a phenomenal documentary about the Cockettes, which debuted at the 2002 Sundance Film Festival. Celebrating the 20th anniversary of its release, I asked David what he thought of the work, looking back at it through time.
It was the first documentary I'd ever made, and also my filmmaking partner, Bill Weber, he had never made documentaries either. He had worked in advertising and music videos as a post-production editor, very high end. And, you know, I'd made weird short films and, you know, stuff like that, and had never had any interest in making documentaries. So it sort of came up out of the blue. It was a kind of a serendipitous kind of thing that happened in a conversation, that this thing erupted out of it and completely changed my life. I had heard of the Cockettes already, you know, in 72-ish, when I was, you know, probably just my last year in high school or just after. They were, you know, there was articles about them in Rolling Stone, and it was intriguing for me because I wasn't out of the closet yet. I still felt like the gays are the guys in mohair sweaters with poodles, and I'm not one of them because I'm a hippie. And so to see these, you know, indisputably hip San Francisco long-haired people, I mean, it didn't get hipper than that, you know, making a pair, you know, that they were these people who were transcending kind of gender stuff, which was language we wouldn't have used then. It was kind of fascinating to me to read in either the LA Free Press or in the Rolling Stone about this thing that was going on in San Francisco. And again, this was right after Stonewall, which didn't get much publicity at the time. I mean, it's not like the whole world was aware of Stonewall. So in a way, the Cockettes were the first thing that I had heard of that was really a kind of a hip sexual rebellion. I wasn't out at all. And so there was an intrigue there. And then probably when I was 19, I saw Trisha's Wedding, the film that the Cockettes made parodying Nixon's daughter's wedding at the White House. And I just thought it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. It was part of a whole world of what was called underground movies that played in every city and at every college campus with great regularity. There was a whole big market for underground movies. And it was the Warhol movies. It was the early John Waters movies. It was also a lot of the European films of that era, Fellini and stuff. And there was a huge, huge audience for these things. And so seeing Trisha's Wedding was very liberating for me. And I thought it was so funny and so just outrageous. And I thought these people are like indisputably hip people. And it kind of helped me come out in a way, because I thought, well, if, you know, if that's one option to do this, I was never attracted to being in drag myself, but I loved it as a kind of a theatrical subversive modality. And then when I lived in Venice, I got to know Goldie Glitters, who was one of the Cockettes. We became pretty good friends. And I also met Lyndon, who was one of the Cockettes. And so they just were part of my consciousness always. It's a long kind of story with lots of different pieces, but I was chatting with someone in San Francisco at Cafe Flore who had played Lady Bird Johnson in Trisha's Wedding. And both of us were saying, well, you know, the Cockettes had this huge impact and really nobody knows who they were except the people who were there then. They're sort of forgotten. And, you know, that's the moment when my life changed. And it was like, you know, I've told this a million times, but what went through my mind was, well, nobody's going to do it if I don't. And if somebody else does do it, they'll do it wrong. And that's how I became a documentary filmmaker. You know, I'm really thrilled that I was as naive as I was about what it would take to make a documentary. I'm totally thrilled that Bill was game. I had reached out to him. We didn't have a huge friendship, but we knew each other, you know, from working together on little projects that he'd helped out with. And we were both deadheads. You know, I knew that we both had a Grateful Dead history, which was, you know, somewhat rare in the gay world. And so I suggested to him, do you have any interest in making the Cockettes? There was actually another idea for a documentary that I had at the same time. And Bill said, yeah, let's do one on the Cockettes. And that's basically how it started. We learned how to make a documentary together. And it was this incredible journey of having to, you know, dig up these people, many of whom hadn't seen each other in two decades or more, and, you know, ascertain whether they'd be open to doing this. And it was like, where's the cameras? You know, for the most part, they couldn't wait. I'm thrilled with it. You know, would we make a different movie now? Most likely. Our filmmaking attitudes are probably much more mature. I think my understanding of certain aspects of the story are very different. It might have a different kind of depth to it in terms of the story, but I'm totally happy with it. I mean, I feel like it really speaks to a universal yearning for certain aspects, for certain elements within the youth of the world to find something differently than what they're told is available to them. And what's been gratifying about the film is that, you know, since it came out, there's generation after generation of new people that find inspiration and comfort in realizing like, oh yeah, there are other freaks out there and it's okay to not go to college if I don't want to. And it's okay to like pursue art. And, you know, that period will never be recreated again, but there are always people that want to break from the norm and break from the mold. And to the extent that the film serves as a kind of a beacon of inspiration in that way, I'm just thrilled about it.
If you had a time machine and could go back in time, what would you change or do differently with this work?
There's aspects of the history that I know much better now. I mean, things related to the Cauliflower Commune and the whole communal life in San Francisco, I think I would probably handle that part of the story differently. I mean, I think Bill would agree with this. So there might be more breathing space in the movie. It moves pretty quickly and there's pretty relentless music all the way through it. My orientation as a filmmaker has been more towards an attitude of like blues and jazz, which is that the space between the notes matter as much, if not more, than the notes themselves. So I think in tone and probably to some degree in content, it would just be different because we're both more mature. Both Bill and I are more mature as filmmakers and as humans.
In 2011, David and Bill Weber teamed up again with their documentary, We Were Here, which examines how dramatically and adversely the AIDS epidemic impacted the Castro in San Francisco. Told through the lens of five individuals, what emerges is a detailed tapestry of grief, resilience, resistance, and strength. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and had its theatrical debut at the Castro Theater in February 2011. I asked David how he views the work and its social impact.
It's the most important thing I've ever done in my life, really, is that film. And again, it was something that I had not given a moment's thought to. It happened very much like the Cockettes. I had a boyfriend who was much younger than me and very smart and also had gone to film school and had heard me tell many stories about what it was like living in San Francisco in those years. And he sort of, I don't remember how exactly it came up, but he sort of prompted the idea of somebody needs to make a documentary because younger people don't really understand what actually happened, particularly younger gay people. And my initial response was, sure as fuck is not going to be me. It's the last thing I want to do is revisit that. And plus my orientation to making films was that I had no interest in doing anything that I thought would be depressing. But again, within a minute, I had the same feeling like, well, nobody's going to do it if I don't. And if someone does, they're going to do it wrong. And that's basically what started We Were Here. And when I look back on the first proposal that I wrote for We Were Here to start raising money, it's so integrated to San Francisco and the hippie counterculture and all of that, because the thesis, and again, it just poured out of me. And there was no clarity of how I was going to tell the story or exactly what story I was going to tell. But I knew that once I realized that I could make this movie, I knew that it had to be a movie that ultimately was inspirational and that it would not leave people down, but that it would leave people with a sense of inspiration around humanity. And I've also in subsequent years realized that both of my films, The Cockettes and We Were Here, are love letters to San Francisco. So in my initial proposal, part of what I said was how different San Francisco was than anywhere else when the AIDS epidemic hit. And part of that was in the post-Stonewall years, and always in history, but certainly in the post-Stonewall years, gay people have moved out of their small towns to go to big cities. First of all, for critical mass, to be able to find sexual and romantic partners, to be safe, and also to be away from the constrictions of their families and churches and small towns. I'll be focusing specifically on gay men here, but you had gay people moving to New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, where there were big, vibrant gay communities. And, you know, other people moved to, you know, more Midwestern places and stuff like that. But it was just the natural progression is that if you wanted to live a gay life, you pretty much had to get out of where you were. So all of these places started to develop large active gay communities, but lots of people went to New York to live a gay life and be a gay life, but they remained in the closet professionally. Same with LA. A lot of people went to LA and stayed in the closet professionally. Nobody stayed in the closet in San Francisco. If you were coming to San Francisco to be gay, you were coming to come out. So what we had was a much more out gay community, which meant that we had a much more politically visible gay community that established a kind of a very strong presence much earlier than any gay community anywhere else. And the other piece of it is that there were all these people in San Francisco who'd come in the 50s and 60s because of the creative social atmosphere in San Francisco, which was unique, and had taken acid and had been involved in anti-war politics and other kinds of politics in the psychedelic period. And a lot of those people were a little older and they had jobs working in public health and they had jobs, you know, working in City Hall and various bureaucracies. So you had an infrastructure of the city that already had an openness to alternative ways of perceiving things, along with this politically powerful gay community. So in a way, when I was writing this proposal for the film, I thought, well, this is really what, and I'd never thought about this before with that kind of intention. The idea was to make a movie that really showed how San Francisco was special and what was the San Francisco model and how did it happen and where did it come from? And I think it is inextricably connected to the Cockettes and to the Beat era and all of that kind of stuff, because it played out very differently in San Francisco, because the emphasis here was on being free and finding our rightful place. That's really, I think, what shaped the movie. Now, some of this stuff is reflective. I've realized how much of my work has been intuitive, and I haven't always necessarily known or would have been able to articulate the underlying intentions. But the intuitive clarity was absolute. But sometimes I'll look back and I go, oh, I didn't really realize I was doing that. But clearly, that's what I was doing. So we were here, it's very much a San Francisco story that would be very different than had I made it about New York or LA. Totally different.
In closing, I asked David what he thought about the future of LGBTQ rights and freedoms in America.
You know, I think a lot of these things are mysterious. How does history work? I mean, I think in many ways, the biggest changes in history have been things that have come completely out of the blue. And as much as I value the notion of activism and work and organizing and stuff, I think they're absolutely essential. The things that have changed the world most profoundly in my life have been JFK, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy's assassinations, Harvey Milk's assassination. I mean, terrible, dark moments. I'm sure a different person could come up with equally positive moments of fabulousness that made positive changes, which certainly there were. But I think intention and activism is only part of it. I mean, in relationship to the whole issue of Haight-Ashbury and counterculture and all of this, in the early years of the counterculture, there's actually an amazing article in Ramparts magazine written by Warren Hinkle, I think in early 1967. And he's sort of trying to interpret these hippies, I don't even know if that word was being used, but the psychedelic people for the left, because there was a sense on many people on the left that is this purely kind of hedonistic and is it fundamentally counter-revolutionary? And it's a really interesting article to capture that moment. On the other side, the acid people and the counterculture people were thinking, no matter how good your politics are, if you haven't changed your consciousness, it doesn't really matter. And in a way, over the next few years, those things started to interweave. But they were very different kind of worldviews at that point. I mean, it's one of the things that helps me out of my pessimism, because I'm very good at kind of speculating the cause and effect of things. And one of the things that acid helped me with was to let go of believing in cause and effect, because you're almost always wrong. I mean, even if you're partially right, you're only getting a little bit of the picture. So there was a moment when I sort of shifted out from being a kind of a more Marxist-oriented, activist-oriented lefty that really believed that, you know, as long, you know, what matters is educating the masses, and ultimately it will lead to, you know, and I, at a certain point I realized, well, this is completely ridiculous. It's not going to work. And really, information is of no value if people aren't open to receiving it. So I think my focus shifted more for myself away from the information and more towards the opening of the heart and the breaking down of the kind of constricted ways of thinking. And in many ways, and I've described it this way in the past, I've wanted my work and in many ways my presence in the world to be like a little bit of acid in the water supply, so that people aren't necessarily realizing that they're tripping, but somehow their perceptions are somewhat altered than what they had been before. So I think that for me, I mean, we all have to find our own paths, even if we consider ourselves idealists and activists. What's the path that works? And I think that's it for me, really, is to try to be a little bit of acid in the water supply, to sort of open people's hearts and minds in ways that maybe they haven't been opened before.